Hello, and welcome to Writers Group Therapy.
I'm Tom.
And I'm Roshni. We're writers helping writers with whatever writing ailments you might have.
Whether it's related to your craft or your career, we can help.
Are you ready for your session?
The doctors are in. On Writers Group Therapy, we are chatting with Steve Schlamm, a Brooklyn-born actor and author whose first novel, The Harvesting of Haystacks Cain, is coming out in March from 8th House Publishing. Steve studied under Joseph Heller, the renowned author of Catch-22 at City University of New York, where he earned his master's degree in creative writing and English. He's lived all over the country and Mexico, but now resides in California. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. You know, you have an interesting background. I was reading your bio. We always like to start with kind of hearing about the writer's journey. Like, how did you come to start writing? I know you started as an actor. How did you decide to become a writer and write your first novel?
Back in the day, I was practicing law and unhappy doing so, as so many lawyers are. And I had kind of fooled around. I'd written for school papers, things of that nature. And I was very, very interested. I was an avid reader, and I love words. I love the way words can be made to sing and dance, and why they have a kind of plastic quality, can be molded and shaped into strings of pearls or swine, one way or the other. And so I started, the first thing I ever wrote was a review of an album by a group now long gone called Hot Tuna, which was composed of several members of Jefferson Airplane. Anyway, from there I started to write. I went to City and I got my master's degree, and of course, did writing while I was there, most of it under the aegis of Joe Heller, who was my teacher and mentor. Somewhere thereafter, I began to write this novel, which is The Harvesting of Haystacks Cain, and it came to me actually in a dream, not full blown by any means, but the last line actually came to me first, and I am not going to tell you what it is. Please read the book and get to it, I hope. But that came to me first, and I was living in Brooklyn Heights, which is the one of the first historic districts in the United States, right near the East River, and with views of the Statue of Liberty and the World Trade Center when it was still up and running. And the Brooklyn Bridge was right there, and it was a hot summer night, which is like the opening to a bad novel, but it was. And I woke up with a start, with that line ringing in my head, and I began to hear voices, and I thought, you know, well, I've finally gone over the line. They're going to come after me with the butterfly nets. And then I realized that it wasn't simply voices, it was characters talking to me, or talking anyway.
Interesting.
And, yeah. And so I got up and I went into my, I was on the sixth floor of a rent controlled building with no air conditioning in this particular room, but that's where I had the space to work. So I went to my desk in the foyer of the apartment and began to write furiously, trying to capture everything that was happening in my head, all the voices saying all the things they were saying. Of course, that's an impossibility, but I managed to capture what I would call leads from every one of the characters, and at least a portion of what they were saying to me, and the rest of it was crossing my fingers and hoping that the rest of it would be there when I needed it. I did this for several hours in the wee small hours of the morning, and at a certain point, I knew that this was not a short story. It wasn't a play. It was a novel. And it would have been, and now has turned out to be, my first novel. And so I was faced immediately with a very, very serious choice, because, and the choice was this, I could stay there and continue writing and forego going to work the next day. I was working as a lawyer, actually, part-time, which is not a job that's easily obtainable, but I managed to. It was a different era. And so I could either go to work and put the novel aside until whenever, until I was able to get back to it, or I could just keep working. And I knew that if I just kept working, I would never go to work again, or at least not until I was either very much in need of money or I finished the book and could go back to work. And I didn't have, in essence, I think, the courage to abandon my conventional life, I'll call it, and just plunge into the world of the might be starving artist. And so I did put it aside, but because I had the kind of schedule that I was able to obtain, from the job I was in, I worked part-time. And so I either worked every day, part of the day, and then went to the office part of the day, or I would work, let's say, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and then Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, I'd write, or something along those lines, working 6 days a week, splitting the time between the two occupations. And on the seventh day, I rested like God, I suppose.
Yeah, you must have needed it after that.
Say it again.
You must have needed it after that.
I sure did. And I.
When did you decide to get your master's in writing in English?
Well, it was I don't remember the exact year, but it was some time ago, Tom, and it was before Joe passed, he was a very, very straightforward, plain spoken guy. I don't know if you know the story of Catch 22, but he was working for Look magazine, which is a dead soldier these days, long gone. And I think he was writing advertising copy or something like that. And he submitted Catch 22 to approximately 60 publishing houses. I don't remember if he ever found an agent, but I know he submitted it to 60 publishing houses. It's a well-known story in the literary community before anybody took a look at it seriously and decided to publish it. And now the term Catch 22 is part of the English language. But he was not a fancy guy. He was not a fancy intellectual. He was a very plain spoken guy, as I said, very down to earth, very New York, very Jewish, and very kind. He was good to me. Once told me I wrote better than he did, which was, of course, a lovely thing to hear. And we would, after class, we would go to his, he lived in one of the grand old apartment buildings on Central Park West, right next to that, I believe it was right next door to the Dakota, the famous Dakota where John Lennon lived and other famous people. And Joe lived in a building, I think it was called the Beresford, or some fancy schmancy English name, you know, implying aristocracy, which it certainly wasn't, but it was a big old comfortable building. And we would go to his apartment, some of the students, and talk about writing and everything else. And eventually, when I left the program, he introduced me to his agent, who was the famous Bob Gottlieb at Knopf. Bob didn't want it, and that's fine. But Joe was always there with whatever help or advice he could offer.
Cool. When did your acting career start, and how did that relate to your writing as well? Where did you act? What kind of stuff did you do there?
I've done mostly the acting career started, let's say, 20. I'd already written the novel when it started, and I was still working, and it was, I saw acting as a, I had fooled around with it when I was young, did some studying, and then, you know, did not pursue it. And so some years later, after I wrote the novel and I was back at work and, you know, looking to sell the novel at the same time, which is the worst part of the whole process. Because you really want to be a writer. You know, you don't want to be a marketer or a salesperson, a promoter. But particularly these days, you're required to. You're required to have, I don't know, social media accounts and a website and put yourself out there in every way, every conceivable way you can come up with. But in any event, to go back to acting, so when I started to do that, to look, you know, to sell the novel, and at the same time was back at work, I felt I needed counterpoint. I needed something that would speak to my soul, not to my pocketbook or even to my head particularly, although acting does that in spades in the end. And so I looked around for some gigs and got them, and they were small gigs. I've done mostly theater in my career. I've done it in New York City, off Broadway. I've done it in Miami, various theater companies in Miami, in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I lived for a few years, back in the aughts. And I've done it in San Miguel de Allende in Mexico, which is an expat town, a very, very, it's a Spanish colonial city filled with expats, most of whom think they want to be artists, or maybe they are, or maybe they might be someday, or something like that. I've done it there as well, and here in San Diego, where I live now.
Very, very cool. Very cool. So let's talk a little bit about the pitching process, because your book is very avant-garde. So what was it like pitching something like that? And how did you, because I know you just said, we hate being marketers, we're artists, but how did you market it to people to say, hey,
well,
take a chance on me?
There's a format, as I think you both know. You have to come up with a synopsis. You have to come up, and it's got to be, the thing is, I'm a words lover, and I don't believe that brevity is always the soul of wit. I think sometimes extensive language is the soul of wit. And so I've never learned to say things in 25 words or less, but you know, every agent and every publisher is inundated with requests for publication, and you always are trying to stand out. I mean, it's the same thing in a sense as what is when you're trying to gain readership by getting reviews or getting people to endorse the novel in blurbs or whatever. I mean, you're always knocking on the door saying, here's what I have, here's who I am, here's what I have. Are you interested? And you have to find a way to create interest. And, you know, sometimes longer pieces work, sometimes they don't. So you have to be careful about who you approach with what. And so, you know, so you have to do a synopsis. You have to do a bio. Are you there? Yeah. Many publishers and agents will request a segment of the novel or a chapter, maybe three chapters. Others will request the entire novel to look at. Others will tell you they don't want any of it. They just want to see the synopsis and the bio. And so then you send it in by these days digitally, and you know, you either hear from them or you don't. When I first started, I used to cold call people, agents and publishers, and I was pretty decent at it, I guess, because I got to talk to people when perhaps ordinarily you wouldn't have. But you know, as years have gone on, And the industry has really turned, in terms of communication, solely to digital communication. You send out an email and attach what you need to attach, and then you wait. And they'll tell you, well, you can follow, if you haven't heard from us in 2 months, it means we're not interested. Or if you haven't heard from us in 2 months, then please send us, you're welcome to send us a follow-up. And that's really it. It's in a way, it's like Match.com or one of those dating sites. You know, you have to find someone who looks at your profile, in this case, the novel itself or a description of it in a synopsis, and is interested in going further with you, you know, interested in dating you, I'll call it. And it's the same really, looking for reviews and endorsements. It's the same thing. You have to find common ground. You have to find a connection with whoever it is, whoever the recipient is. And so it's an arduous process. In some sense, it's a creative process because you're always looking for an angle, a hook, that will reel in that particular candidate for whatever it is you're asking for. And you do it every single day. Because if you don't, in all likelihood, without a lucky break, a connection that somehow gets you in a door you would otherwise never be able to get into. And not only do you get in, but the person on the other side of the door really likes what you're saying and what they see in your work. Unless you have that, the rest of it is just, it's all chance. It's chance in the sense of, even if you identify someone who you believe is a good candidate to give you, to publish your book or represent your book or give you a review, et cetera, et cetera. There's no guarantee, on the other hand, that that person, even if they are a good candidate, is going to respond favorably. That often comes down to, it can come down to where they're at the moment they're in contact with you or work on you, or in the end, the quality of the work and whether it fits with the type of work they are interested in dealing with. So.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a unique pitch you've got, because, you know, The Harvesting of Haystacks Cain is sort of a Christmas Carol kind of story where, you know, it's a lot of first person recollections. It's a lot of stream of consciousness.
Yes.
The ghosts of Herschel's past come to see him in the hospital, retelling the stories of his life, his ex-wife, his friend, his mother, his archenemy. And literally actually, there was one review I was reading. It said, it's a masterful use of stream of consciousness narrative technique that brings a remarkable plasticity to the literary form, immersing the readers in Haystack's innermost thoughts, emotions, and memories. I thought that was a perfect explanation of it. Well, how did you come up with the idea to tell this story? Why this story, and why this method to tell it?
That's a complicated question, or maybe it isn't. I mean, as I said to you, the novel came to me in a dream, and it came to me. I mean, the form is a series of monologues, essentially, in which, or I'll call it point counterpoint, in which Herschel, who is my main character and who wrestles under the name of Haystacks Cain, was born Herschel Cain, and they changed his name, which is a significant event even unto itself, I should say. But in any event, he will be ruminating, thinking about something. He's injured, don't forget. He's been gravely injured in a match with Valentino, who's the champion, who holds the championship he much longs for and is his arch rival and nemesis. And so he's very gravely injured in that match. And so he's lying in his hospital bed, really two hospital beds lashed together to take account of his weight. And because he weighs 607 pounds. And he's immobilized and he can't speak. And he drifts in and out of consciousness. And so these ghosts from his past, as you put it, some are from his past, some are from his present. I leave it to the reader to decide whether those people, each of them, are actually sitting in the room as visitors or are simply speaking to him in his own disordered inner world, as in a sense the book spoke to me in my own that night when it came to me in a dream. So the format of those, that point counterpoint, those contrasting monologues, I'll call them, that came to me right away. Once I got over the initial burst of literary energy that night when I had the dream, it just presented itself to me. And as for stream of consciousness, I don't know as I ever made a conscious decision to utilize it. Inasmuch as the action in this book is largely interior action. I mean, it's not that there aren't scenes and from his life and that show relations with other characters, and there aren't scenes involving just the other characters. The action is always the basic action of the novel is internal, interior. It is a novel of consciousness, and consciousness can be is not doesn't necessarily express itself in ordered sentences as we do, for example, right now, because what we're doing is filtering ideas that don't come necessarily in sequence or coherently together, and taking those ideas and filtering them through the articulation capability that every brain contains. But a lot of thought, a lot of thought, particularly thought mixed with emotions, does come in bursts and in phrases and in segments as opposed to polished sentences. My literary hero, if I can digress for a moment, is William Faulkner, who in my judgment is the, for me, the greatest writer I've ever encountered, at the very minimum, and who uses stream of consciousness beautifully and well, particularly in The Sound and the Fury, which is one of the greatest novels ever written. Did I consciously steal from Faulkner? Not consciously, but is he in my own consciousness so that I have a almost a kind of a sense memory of what his words, how they're presented? Of course I do. And it's the same for Joyce and any number of other writers. You know, he said once that he wanted to put the entire world in a single sentence. And that struck me like a lightning bolt, because it's exactly what I would like to do. Put the whole world in a single sentence.
In some cases, you kind of put a lot of words into a single sentence, going with the train of thought kind of thing. I mean, there was like whole pages with no punctuation in some cases. You know, that's a really bold decision to try to do something like that. And you actually put everything, a lot of it is in Haystack's own voice, which is, you know, not an omniscient narrator, but a very stylized, very, very specific accent and language structure.
That's right. That's right. That's a very good observation, Tom, and it's correct. But again, it's not something I sat back and thought about and made a conscious decision to do. when it, again, it presented itself to me, it was the natural expression of that character's consciousness about the subject that he is putting forward. When it presented itself to me that way, I ratified that subconscious decision, you know. It felt right to me. It seemed right to me. If I had written what I wrote and a lot of it is written, I should say, in ordinary sentences. It's ordinary narrative. But there are chunks of it that are laced throughout the entire narrative that are stream of consciousness or modified stream of consciousness. And they often occur at what I believe are pivotal moments in the character's life. I could have chosen to take that material and rework it into standard sentences, but I chose not to because, again, it felt right to me. And to go back to what I said about putting the whole world in a single sentence, I think that if I could write music, I used to sing rock and roll when I was young. I didn't have a career really, but I did some singing and did some gigs and so on. If I could write music, I wouldn't be sitting here talking with you right now. Because language to me is music. I said in the beginning of the interview that, it has a plastic quality to it, a moldable quality. And I believe that there are layers of meaning in language. And I'm not just talking about text and subtext. I'm talking about there is the literal meaning of the words, which conveys concepts to us, attitudes and such. And then there is a kind of a subtext in the sense of, it's hard for me to express this, and I apologize, but the words have a meaning that transcends the actual literal meaning of the word, that the motion and rhythm of the words produce an experience that is nonverbal, and ironically, that is an experience of feeling and sense and at its very best, kind of epiphany, much like music does. And so
that's interesting.
Quality of language I always that always interests me and that I always want to explore and hope that I did so in this novel. But again, it's not all that way.
You've definitely put together something truly unique here. It's an interesting read. I read quite a bit of it actually. I found it, you know, challenging from a way to read, you know, the inner thoughts of somebody. It's very different from your typical average novel. So you've really made something that stands out here.
Thank you. There is. I'm sorry, but I'm sorry to interrupt. But there is, as I said before, I think conventional narrative. I mean, it's not just thoughts, random thoughts. In other words, it's not all stream of consciousness by a long shot. Mm-hmm. There is recounting, Haystack's recounting portions of his life. Are you still there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Because my screen went off. As I said, there are portions where he is recounting incidents in his life, scenes from his life, as there are as well in the segments from each of the other monologists or narrators that appear in the novel. His mother, his ex-wife, his best friend, who is an African-American small person wrestler, a midget wrestler, as they always used to say,
mm-hmm.
and so on. Consciousness presented itself to me in that form, in the form of of the river, what I'll call the river of words, all of which do not form neat and pretty sentences.
No, they don't. If people want to get your book or find out more about you, where can they do that?
Well, they can look on my website, which is www.steveschlamm.com. They can access, and we are in the process of adding to the website, and so there'll be more information coming within the next few weeks. They can also contact, they can look on my publisher's website, which is www.8thhousepublishing.com, 8th being spelled 8, numeral 8, T-H.
Wonderful. Cool. Well, I wish you so much luck with this book. It's really interesting. I hope people will check it out.
Yeah.
And we will be back in a couple of weeks with more writing and writers. Do follow us on social media, on Instagram and Twitter at WG Therapy, and visit writersgrouptherapy.com for more episodes. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.